now with the virtual world, we're actually able to engage with scientists from different parts of the world and then connect with their networks.
There has become sort of broad recognition that we have a responsibility in higher education to provide our PhD students with a broader set of skills and competencies.
That can be another way of getting information that you might not know.
You're listening to Vitamin PhD, a podcast from Boston University delivering career narratives and know-how to supplement your doctoral studies.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to our episode on research ethics. I'm Matt Boyd, one of your co-hosts for this season of the Vitamin PhD podcast, where we're talking about all things research skills.
And hello, listeners. I'm Heather Mooney, and I'm also so excited to talk with Dr. Renee Spencer and Liz Ramirez during today's episode. And we'll let them introduce themselves now.
I'm Renee Spencer. I'm a professor in the School of Social Work and currently serving as the chair of the Institutional Review Board, or the IRB, for the Charles River Campus at BU, which has been an interesting journey, important role and an interesting journey. My background is in social work and developmental psychology, and I do research on youth mentoring.
I'm Luis Ramirez. I'm a now fifth-year PhD candidate in the graduate program for neuroscience, and I work with Dr. Sam Lang investigating how we see and also how we remember things from moment to moment, and how attending to things improves what we see. And a lot of my approaches are behavioral and also using non-invasive human imaging to look at the brain while we show people things and they do and make some sort of judgment on the things we show them. And from there, we kind of get a window into what's going on into the brain.
Awesome. Thank you both so much. And yeah, that was, you know, what you guys are talking about, right? The IRB is this sort of big apparatus, right? And the hidden curriculum, right? Not just of graduate school, but also the IRB and doing research in general, right? So we're really happy to have you both here and explore those ideas with you. So we're going to start sort of pretty big. Really, what does research mean to you? Sort of overall, when you think about research, what comes to mind? And feel free to be as detailed as you'd like in your answers.
No. If I wanted to distill it into a sentence, to me, I felt like for the past 10 years or so, I've been invested in studying what's real. How do we agree upon what's real? And to me, research has been that, you know, that pursuit of knowledge, fundamental truths, if we could call it that. Yeah, I mean, at first I started in physics and philosophy, and it's also been interesting to see the different ways, different fields define what is considered research. Because my first research experience was really just reading and theory and just thinking about different models of physics, and now doing neuroscience, it feels like a different beast in its own entirety. Not that the research in philosophy of physics isn't, has its own degree of rigor, right? But it definitely feels like there's different rules because now subjects are involved, right? You have to consider, you have to be transparent about what you're doing. Yeah, I guess that's part of the definition too. Research is transparent. It should be. So I'll end it with that. Research is.
Yeah, it should be. I'm thrilled to hear you say that, Luis, that's to your mind, one of the principles of research. Because from, again, the perspective of the IRB, transparency sure should be one of them. And kind of building off of what you're talking about, I mean, I think for me at its core, research is asking a question you really don't know the answer to. So you're going into the enterprise of trying to understand something and better understand, you know, the human experience, the human world, the physical world as well, in ways that we don't currently have an understanding for. And I think that's where sometimes in the social sciences, people can get into trouble. People start asking questions they already know the answer to. Then why are you bothering talking to people, or you think you know the answer to, then why are you going to involve other people in this process and bother with it? You know, if you've got your ideas already. So to my mind, real research is when you really don't know the answer and you're trying to find something out and learn something. But, you know, I think the other comment that Lewis made that I think was really important is that there's a system to it, that part of the research enterprise that's different than just being kind of curious about something is having a set of procedures that you're following that you've collectively agreed on as kind of a knowledge community, and you're going through those procedures. Now, hopefully over time, those procedures evolve. As our knowledge evolves. And so we change how we think about knowledge construction kind of the more we know. But it's a complex world out there. And I think there are lots of ways, lots of different kinds of answers and lots of ways to get there. And we need it all if we're going to really understand our world in meaningful ways.
So you guys both just gave these beautiful, very vivid and rich answers, but sort of chop it down a little bit. In 3 to 5 words, could you finish the sentence for us? Research is?
I would say the systematic pursuit of knowledge.
I'll add, research is the transparent pursuit of knowledge and some agreed upon truth. So, yeah.
So sort of most broadly, tell us about ethics and research. What does that mean to you in terms of project construction, design, analysis, and dissemination? Really, any reflections on that would be great.
I feel like given my work isn't so heavy to the point where I could really, really dig into making sure, you know, subjects are okay, like I'm not doing anything invasive. There's a lot of systems in place already to ensure that we respect the subject's privacy and keep their data anonymous and all that. I do feel like autonomy, respecting the autonomy of subjects comes to mind, being transparent.
Exactly. I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, those are really at the heart of things. You know, the transparency. I mean, the classic mandate in ethics is that first, do no harm. You know, that's really what we have to have at the forefront of our minds, is that we're doing things that are that won't harm people in ways that we know we can't. You know, that if we can predict harm, then we ought to be mitigating it and doing something about that to prevent that from happening. So that's kind of the first mandate. But to make that happen, I think it requires exactly what Lewis was talking about, which is transparency and respect. I think those are at the core. It's really making sure that your study, whatever you're studying and whatever form it takes, is designed in a way that creates safety for the participants. If you're talking about human subjects, if you're talking about people that are going to be participants in your study, it needs to be safe for them. It needs to be, if you're in uncertain territory, like we have to. I have a daughter as a chronic illness. I have been the direct benefit of drug research, for example, where there are people who take the risk of taking that medication first. And we don't, you know, we've done as much as we can do, but still you don't know until you give it to a bunch of people and they try that medication. So they're under those circumstances, though, people have to know what they're getting themselves into. And that's that transparency piece that Lewis was talking about, that we're very explicit with people about the status of what we know and the risks that they're taking if they want to participate. And there are risks in some cases, in some fields, to get answers to questions. But participants, boy, they really need to understand what those risks are. And that's where we've gotten in trouble, and kind of what the IRB grew out of was really not attending to the fact that there are human beings who are taking risks, and they need to make clear choices about those risks, and that it's our job to make sure that they're informed. And it seems super straightforward, like, of course I don't want to do harm, and of course, you know, I'm going to tell people. But I think what can be difficult to, what can be easy to lose sight of when we're the researcher and in this world and in our world all of the time, that if you're inviting people in as participants who don't live in this world, there's assumed knowledge that we're carrying that we sometimes forget to make explicit to the participant. And I think this is why the IRB can feel frustrating at times, because really it's our job to look at it from the person walking down the street's perspective, to look at that consent form and go, could somebody pick this consent form up and really understand the purpose of this research and what they're being asked to do? So we go back to investigators who have written things in pretty jargony terms or in ways that would make sense if you're an insider in that field. But the person walking down the street doesn't know that language and doesn't know what that means. And that consent form has to be written in a way that they understand. The other thing that can be complex and surprising is that consent can change along the way depending on the nature of the study. So those longitudinal studies, there's formal consent from, you know, the process that you go through and the IRB and all of that. But then there's also like, do participants really understand? So there are what I think of as these kind of ethical moments when you're working with participants of where you may realize, wait a minute, are we on territory where I think one thing's happening and they think something else is happening? You may not go through a formal re-consent process, but you might have a conversation with the person about, okay, here's what's happening next. And here's what we talked about. And is this all making sense? And do you have any questions now that you didn't have at the beginning that I can help answer, that you're sort of really walking with people through the process and making it, again, for them as transparent as possible so that they really understand what they're being asked to do and what the risks are for them.
Next up, we have another opportunity to hear from our excellent graduate student panel. We asked them to reflect on research ethics in their fields.
I think for me, what ethics means in the context of the research I do, which is, you know, using samples from studies that have gone on in field sites where individuals are chronically exposed to parasites and develop disease. For me, ethics is presenting my research in a way that doesn't come off as imperialistic, that doesn't come off as, you know, very Western in thinking, that making sure that when I present my research, I'm talking about the individuals that partook in these studies. And so that it's not just, oh, sample A, but no, this is a community in X part of the world. And they are have these very specific, you know, prevalence of disease or very specific outcomes of the disease. And for me, that's my ethical focus, because at the end of the day, I don't ever want people to walk away from a research talk that I do or a research talk that our lab does and think, oh, okay, that's you know, they've answered some questions about the disease. But no, I want them to walk away understanding this is has a very detrimental impact on people. And so at the end of the day, we are asking these questions and we're pursuing these research questions because we want to make sure that this disease doesn't exist anymore in 10, 20 years, that there's an elimination of this disease. Because yes, from, you know, our standpoint here in the US, it's not impacting us. But remove yourself from that thinking, and this, you know, the human side of the research is so important to me.
There, I think with this, like the question of like our positionalities within our research. And you know, and I think it needs to be kind of deeper than that. You know, and I think it is you know, like as a transgender person doing this project, I think like that gives a little bit of, I think, I mean, it at least explains my interests in a way that doesn't quite like seem, but it like too, like fetishizing of like a transgender experience, which, but I think like the reality is that there's no monolithic like transgender experience or transgender identity, or I think even like to call like a transgender community is like so overly simplistic, right? Because there's not really one, you know, community. And so honoring those things, and I think like really moving with like the moving within those limitations, acknowledging those limitations of the project, that you know, that there is space for more stuff to come out. In terms of like designing my own project, I think it's, you know, it's been very important to me, I think, to move away from, I think, like the question of like making bodies hyper visible or invisible. And so like, you know, working within like these like questions that are kind of a little bit outside of the body so much. So following, you know, the how bodies are processed, you know, it was an intentional kind of, I think, like aversion for me of making that, you know, that thing that happens a lot, I think, in the studies of like marginalized populations, the overfixation of the body. I think reckoning with like where you see your own absences in your project, and what kind of fell out of the project and why, which isn't to say like you reincorporate them in, you know, like you just like slap it back in there, but you know, but that you grapple with it and think like, okay, like, why did that fall out, and where can we go next?
So I think the ethics that are most important are obviously like patient confidentiality, which typically at my, where I'm at, that's not really a concern because I just get the samples. I don't know where they're from. I don't know any other details besides just I have these samples that are labeled 1, 2, 3. So that's like the main concern, but obviously like data fabrication is a huge concern. And making sure that your experiments are repeatable. I don't know if that's necessarily an ethical, in the explicit definition of ethical, but if you're the only person that can do your experiments, that's not the best, especially for like sharing that and having other people be able to do it. And so I think that's what I consider with my own personal research. Obviously, like I said, the confidentiality with the patients, but making sure that I'm doing my work in a way that's not specific to me, like you have to hold the pipette a certain way to be able to make sure this actually worked. And yeah, just being completely open on when I write the papers and like the methods section of exactly everything I did, because I think that lacks in a lot of scientific papers. Making sure that someone can look at this and really be able to repeat it. Even if that means my papers are super long, at least like people know how to do it.
Yes, I mean, I think the intro to sociology lecture on what ethics does not look like, what are not ethical things. I mean, I think that for me, you know, aside from the discussion on ethics, since we don't do all that much experimentation, I think our major ethical concerns are one, methodology, and two, in what happens to our research after we have done that research. So as far as ethics and methodology, right, like be responsible for the claims that you're making. Because if you try to make claims that shoehorn something that doesn't work, or you try to claim something that you cannot, right, there can be major issues with this. I also think especially with different types of work, we should be responsible over the scope of our claims, whether something is generalizable or not, but also the limitations of our measurement, right? It's great. I mentioned earlier, you know, gender disparities in work, and that's wonderful that we have these generalizable claims about how this works. But really, we're measuring, you know, a gender binary, right? And we know that gender does not work in that way. And so being ethically responsible as to how you measure, how you have the ability to measure, and, you know, what the implications of that are, or where you can't answer a question. Someone else needs to, you know, take the baton and step in. I think that's an incredibly important ethical consideration. I also think, you know, what happens to your research after you let it go is not fully our responsibility, right? You know, I'm not responsible for the misappropriation of my work. However, I am responsible for making my work as clear as it can possibly be so that misappropriation is purposeful. Someone would have to, on purpose, right, take what I've done and transform it in a way that it was not meant to in order to do, you know, harm. So I think being responsible for what we do and saying what our limitations are, but also being really clear about what we contribute. This knowledge is not just knowledge, right? It can feed into something that's real. I think that that's important.
Excellent. Yet another fantastic round of thoughtful reflections from our graduate student panelists. In order, the people that you heard there were Amanda Ruiz, a pathobiology student at Brown University, Dana Ahern, a feminist studies scholar at UCSB, Kiara Lee, biomedical engineering student at Brown University, and Kristen Zock, a sociology PhD student right here at BU.
Yeah, that was great. I just wanted to take a moment and go back to what Dr. Spencer actually said earlier about ethical moments in the research process. This term really resonates with me because research from inception to dissemination is an ongoing and iterative process that you need to reflect on and adjust accordingly. And this is true both within projects and across them. And thinking about these ethical moments, Dr. Spencer, how do you take them into account for different subject populations with different experiences? So for instance, when I was working as a research assistant on a study about the short and long-term effects of solitary confinement, we were interviewing people incarcerated in supermax prisons who were also in the hole, which is another term for solitary confinement. And because of how deprived their conditions are, the PIs or the principal investigators went back and forth about providing incentives for participants. And ultimately, we weren't able to provide any incentives or thank yous. Usually it's like, oh, here's a $10 gift card to wherever. But we aren't allowed to do that just by virtue of how awful that situation is and how coercive it is just inherently. So with that in mind, how do you think about ethics, ethical moments, and the ethical process for different subject populations that you're working with different experiences of marginalization and vulnerability?
Yeah, I really think that is such a moving target and ongoing process and is really hard and something that we need to think hard about, because I think that what you're describing is the default case. So because people are incarcerated, offering them any incentive can be feel coercive. And that's one of the principles of not doing harm, is not coercing participants. So if you're offering somebody who has so little something, then they might be doing it just for that incentive, and they're willing to take risks they wouldn't otherwise take and potentially suffer some harm for that benefit that you're holding out for them. And we don't want to be taking advantage of people when they're vulnerable. That said, right, at the same time, maybe they want to participate. Maybe there's, you know, a benefit to society and they're in on that and they think that's a great idea and they'd like to participate. And you'd like to be able to thank them for doing that, even though, again, they're in this incredibly limited situation, right? But still, it's something as a human being they're offering up for the greater good. So I think the regulation on that has been you can't do it because it's coercive. But I'm hoping as we continue to problematize these conversations, we can come up with better answers than that. It's easy to just say never do it. I think the harder part is under what conditions does it make sense? And what protections do we put in place to go into some of those gray areas? And I think those some of those gray areas are we need to go. And this is where we need everybody at the table in higher education. I think the more people who come into higher education with various backgrounds of all sorts and who come join and get involved in research, that these kind of questions will get asked and answered in some different ways.
Lewis, did you have anything you wanted to add there?
I really resonated with the bit about communicating the motivation of the research to subjects in a way that they can understand. Because I think even outside of the lab, I think it's important as scientists or researchers to be able to communicate your research in a way that doesn't feel esoteric. I think to an extent, I think that's one of the branches of ethics. You know, I don't think it's one of the more, you know, when we think of harm, right? It's not one of the direct avenues of harm, but I think in a way it's a more subtle long-term form of harm. I think it's an intellectual kind of harm, I think, to keep people from knowing what it is that's going on, where their money is going, and the kind of questions that are being pursued and who's answering those questions too.
So thinking a little bit about the IRB, I know at least, you know, I've worked on qualitative and mixed method studies, some with high risk subject populations and some, you know, with white women who are interested in true crime, right? Two very different groups of people. So the IRB utility can be contested, right? For some qualitative researchers, especially who are working on things, areas like culture, right? So can you tell us a little bit about what the IRB is, pros and cons, and any sort of reflections on, you know, why it's here and what its use is?
Yeah, so, you know, the reason why the IRB is here, unfortunately, is because of the past transgressions where people were not informed of their rights, where unfortunately really egregious experiments were conducted. The Tuskegee syphilis study is one example. People denied treatment, not being told there was a treatment. So not even knowing that they could access a treatment that was available to them and just sort of watching what happened to people. I mean, it's just horrific, the things that led to the formation of the IRB. So fortunately, we now have these kinds of procedures in place where scientists are accountable to one another and to a larger community and sort of saying, what are our practices and what are the ethics here, and that somebody has to look over our shoulder and check us a little bit, that we're not the only ones making these decisions when we're talking about other people's lives, that you know, there's a group of people and a rotating group of people, ideally in a healthy institution where people serve, you know, move and serve on the IRB, so they sort of see what this process looks like and contribute to it. But that people are really looking out for who the participants are. So that to me is at the heart of the IRB, is really it's about just what it sounds like, the protection of human subjects, the protection of participants in research, and taking steps to maintain that. I think that increasingly I've watched a recognition that different kinds of research require different kinds of oversight. The drug studies that I mentioned, you know, you really need a lot of oversight for those. If you're going to sit down and talk to a teacher about classroom practices, that's a whole different, the stakes are quite different under those conditions, although there might be some conditions under which that's high stakes, depending on their context, depending on their environment. So it's really thinking about, I really think it requires thinking about those different individual studies and what the risks are. And there are these, so some studies have much less oversight, where the principal investigator really just has to file with the IRB what the procedures are. The IRB staff go over it and make sure they're sort of in keeping with the regulations of how, you know, what we've collectively agreed upon and what the laws are around human subjects research, and then where there are gray areas and there may be more back and forth with an investigator to sort. So if you're working on your application and you're wondering, gee, I don't know whether this requires this kind of consent or how I should word this, or how to pick up the phone and call the analyst at the IRB and ask, because they're more than willing to talk with you and give you ideas even of ways they've seen. They've seen so many of these protocols. Well, here's how I've seen investigators handle it. Here's some sample language that might get you started in thinking about that. It really is meant to be a back and forth. The spirit of it, you know, it's different at different institutions, but I'll say at BU, the spirit of it is we're in this together to really look out for the people who are being generous and participating in the research, and it's a collective endeavor. So the IRB wants to help investigators do the very best job they can. There are also in some of the schools and colleges a designated IRB person. So they're not the person who's serving on the committee, but they're the person who locally is meant to be a resource. We have somebody like that in the School of Social Work. So you can also get consultation from them. Consultation from colleagues is also, you know, anybody in your department, you know, who's doing work like you're doing is great as well. But so there's lots of resources. Contacting the IRB straight out is excellent. I highly recommend that people do that. And there may be local resources too.
I don't have anything to add necessarily, but I do have a question for Dr. Spencer, I guess. You know, I sometimes think when the public tries to engage with the idea of an IRB, sometimes you'll see a fear of why do we even need that in the first place? But rather than think about everything you've outlined, right, they think, what could you possibly be doing to people that warrants an IRB, right? And I guess I'm asking for advice, like, have you dealt with concerns like that? And then also, how do you walk through answering something like that, or I guess addressing those concerns in a way that isn't dismissive?
You mean if I'm following you correctly? So so say you're trying to get consent from a participant, and there's this language in there about the IRB, and the participant's going, "Well, that's kind of scary. Like, there's this board that oversees, and what's up with that? Is that?" Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think it really is. To me, it kind of cuts to the our kind of core humanness in some ways. Like, as human beings, we can get in our lanes and we have our own agendas and we really want to pursue our own goals, and we can put blinders on and forget about how our actions impact others in really profound ways, because we're so focused on, you know, the thing that's in front of us. And that what IRBs do is open us up and get us back into a community and have a conversation about the things that we're doing as researchers, and whether or not they're, you know, whether we're truly engaging research in a way that doesn't do harm to people. And hopefully does more than that, contributes to the public good. But we don't know that until we do our studies, whether or not we're going to learn anything that's actually helpful at the end of the day. So in that process, we want to not want to be hurting anybody. So I think of talking with people about, it's just a check and balance. It's a, nobody should be doing stuff out there all by themselves. And so it's a check and balance to make sure that we're thinking about what the implications are of people who participate in our research and what the consequences might be for them. And that we no one person can imagine all of that by themselves. You know, it requires kind of a community of people to help us think about that. And then at the, you know, that's kind of the, you know, just sort of human factor end. And then there is, as we sure want to be sure that somebody isn't doing something that's really egregious and harmful. And one of the ways that issue that we didn't bring up today that can get sticky are kind of conflicts of interests. And they're increasing as there is a lot of conversation between people in the academy and in industry and like who's funding the study. And that really needs to be explicit. And, you know, that there are these self-interests that people have. We have our careers in, you know, stakes in these research. And so when you've got a lot of self-interest at stake, it becomes especially important to just have somebody else looking over your shoulder and weighing in on what you're doing. And so that's kind of how I try to think about it is we no one person should be in doing this stuff alone. And the IRB is one way to have other people, you know, engaging with us around our practices and hopefully asking us important questions about how we're doing those practices and whether we are, in fact, making sure people aren't getting hurt in our efforts to try to do good.
Yeah. And as someone who's new to the even concept of an IRB, that's very useful kind of insight and way of thinking about it. Yeah.
So I guess I was just wondering, earlier, Dr. Spencer, you mentioned our findings, right? What happens with our findings? And that's something that we're really sort of wondering, because we can do we can have ethics in mind in planning, we can go through the IRB, make sure we're doing no harm, and still our findings can have negative implications for our subject populations, for our participants. And that's kind of scary. So we were wondering sort of, how do you sort of mitigate those concerns? And how do you sort of balance that with this sort of broader scientific agenda, right, of knowledge production?
Yeah, I think that is one of the important frontiers. And I don't think we really have good systematic ways of looking at that. And it's so important. There was a book by sociologist Unequal Childhoods, where the Annette Leroux did an amazing job in that book, where she went back to her participants. The book took off, so it was way more widely read than I think she ever dreamed it would be. And the participants saw what she wrote, and there were these in-depth ethnographies about their lives. And she does a very clear-eyed analysis, then kind of reports back how participants responded and talks about participants who were angry with her and why they were angry with her. And I think it's everybody doing this kind of work should read that book to get you thinking about the unintended ways. So she didn't intend to have those consequences, but those were consequences. And the kind of clear-eyed look at consequences is how we're going to learn and think about this going forward. And I have to say, I don't have answers for this. I think it's so important that we're asking these questions. I think we need to be asking these questions. We do things like de-identify information, try to make it anonymous, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But even so, I can be anonymous, but she's talking about a participant who picks up the book and was hurt by her interpretation of them. Right? That's a totally different set of issues to think about. And there aren't currently regulations about that or rules about that. But there is a lot of conversation about it. And I think it's a very important conversation. The other great book along these lines is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, who was the original person from whom cells that form the foundation of biological sciences were drawn without her knowledge. The kind of consequences to the family and sort of really, it's complicated. It is that, so we do all of this stuff going in, but I think what happens on the other side is something that we haven't really addressed in a systematic way. And I think it needs it. And I think the people like you asking these questions is what's really going to push us in that direction.
Can I ask a tangential question that hopefully will be relatively quick? Because I come at this from a computer engineering and robotics perspective. And so one of the things I think about in my work, I'm interested in automation and automating away some jobs. And my interest isn't in taking away people's jobs, making, you know, the economy more efficient and doing things better. But in the long term, that's going to lead to people losing their jobs and changing their lives. That's not directly related to anything I'm doing, but it's definitely an implication. How do we frame those considerations that feel tangential even more tangential.
Yeah. You are squarely in Lewis's territory now, the philosopher. I think those are very serious philosophical questions.
That's hard because I also have similar concerns about the work I do. Like it feels almost detached. Like the impact itself feels so down the line in the future that it seems it's not a pertinent thing or an alarming thing to worry about in the moment. But I think you should use that concern to really drive how you interpret your research, and also using that to kind of engage with those sort of questions, at least on an academic level, because there are people who study and try to answer that question, that concern exactly. You know, there are people that make predictions about how robotics and AI will shape the future. And the connection there, I guess, for me was, even though I'm studying, you know, perception and attention and working memory, which can kind of sound abstract, you know, so at some point, we're going to be able to kind of characterize individual differences of attention and someone's perceptual and working memory ability, right? So once we're able to do that in the lab, some people will be able to do that maybe outside of the lab, right? And it will be commercialized. Those are kind of fears. It sounds almost like sci-fi, science fiction. But there's a lot of things today that used to be sci-fi 100 years ago or more, or not even, a couple decades ago. So I don't know, I feel like I didn't really give you an answer there, but I think, I guess my answer would be is to keep thinking about that. I think finding an answer that satisfies you and then also motivates you to answer more, I guess, precise questions, and also engaging with work that's out there, and remembering you're not alone and thinking about these things, I think really, really helps you keep going. I think it's helped me keep going.
Thank you both for being here. One takeaway that I'm getting from this conversation is the value of having this type of dialogue across disciplines. Because it's really easy for me to be in my silo in my robotics brain, thinking about something and having conversations with people from other disciplines like this who approach research in different ways is just really helpful for me. And also just thinking about the ethical implications of our different research interests from totally different perspectives helps inform my perspective and take the blinders off again. So thank you both for chatting with us. This has been very helpful, and I'm sure our audience will find it interesting as well.
Yes, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with us. We're very grateful, and I definitely agree with what Matt just said there. Cross-disciplinary conversations, especially regarding something as broadly defined as research, can really help enrich our understanding of our own disciplines, our projects, and the ethical questions associated with both of those things. And as always, for more information about our guests, graduate student panelists, and the Vitamin PhD podcasts, check out our show notes and website. Talk soon.